You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. We're transported to St. Petersburg on New Year's Eve, 1916. That's the year that Marina Makarova, a young woman of privilege, of flirtations and sleigh rides, is about to be swept up by the forces of history, an ordinary woman living in extraordinary times, living out the chaos of 1917, love affairs with radicals, disownment from her bourgeois family, her life roiled and shaped by the violent transformation of Russia by the Bolsheviks. Janet Fitch has nurtured a long-lived passion for Russian literature and history, which you'll hear about tonight in conversation with the Los Angeles Review of Books executive editor, Boris Druliuk. Let's have a shout-out for the LA Review of Books. Yes. Janet grew up here in Los Angeles and early on fell under the spell of the great Russians, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and continued her studies in Russian at Reed College. I met Janet, Reed College, let's have a chat. I met Janet here in Los Angeles in the early 90s when we were both in the same tutoring program after the LA Uprising, and one of Janet's qualities that I noted from those days is one that I'm sure many of you in this room and in the literary community can also attest to over the decades. Not only is Janet passionately dedicated to her own writing and to the pursuit of literature, but she is truly one of the most generous writers and teachers around, and I'm sure there are many of her students in this room, and she's just deeply beloved in this community. Her first novel, White Oleander, was a number one bestseller and an Oprah's Book Club selection. It's been translated into 24 languages and was made into a feature film. And her novel, Paint It Black, was also a bestseller and has been made into a film by Amber Tamblyn. Boris Druliuk is a Russian literature scholar with a PhD in Slavic literature from UCLA. Among his recent translations are two of my favorite books, Isaac Bebel's Red Cavalry and Odessa Stories. He's the co-editor of the Penguin Book of Russian Poetry, and he translated much of the Russian poetry in Janet's novel, The Revolution of Marina M. So let's give a hometown welcome to Janet Fitch and Boris Druliuk.
Oh, thank you so much for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to see you. I never thought I would finish this book. Most of you have known me. Well, I've been writing this book. And people would say, so when are you going to be done with the book? And it's like I always felt like a soldier face down in the mud, crawling through the ditches and under the wire and having somebody lean over and go, so when's the war going to be over? Hey, I'm just trying not to be killed. And yet you stay with something long enough, it does come to a close. So I thought I would read first, and then we're going to have a conversation with Boris, who knows the book well. It starts in 1932. This book came out of a failed novel that started in L.A., and it just never came together. But I always liked this character, and I start on New Year's Eve, 1932, Carmel by the Sea. Rocking on the razor-muscled bay, lulled by the sleepy toll of buoy bells, the music of rigging, the eloquent stanzas of the waves, I wait for news from the sea. No boys and girls play on the deserted beach now. Only a few stoic fishermen huddle on upturned buckets. The slow labor of the poet, building himself a stone house at the cove's south end, makes for mild entertainment. If I knew him better, I'd tell him the danger of trusting to solid things. It's an illusion. All one needs is a rented cabin, a decent stove, a small boat, a garden gone to seed for winter. I watch the lanky form of my landlord's son crossing the shingle, coat collar up, stopping by to collect rents. I have the money in a cigar box back in my cabin, most of it anyway. It's only $5. The shack's not built for winter. I don't complain. There are shutters to block out a storm and an iron stove with a solid pipe. In a few minutes, I'll beach my boat on the pebbly shore and give him his due. We'll share a bottle of homebrew. Perhaps he'll bring a flask. No liquor on the premises just now, though it will come down soon from San Francisco. Those who love poetry, even my unreadable foreign brand, are tender breed. Why don't you write in English, Marina? Asked my friend Elizabeth. You speak it so well. My dilemma. My English is good enough for the little stories I publish in pulp magazines, but for poetry one needs one's native tongue. The voice of the soul is not so easily translated, though to say soul here is already wrong. We say dusha, meaning not just the spiritual entity, but the person himself. A tug on the line. I pull in a shining perch, shockingly alive. I add it to a rockfish in my pail and row back to shore. I spare the gas when I can. At times like this, I surprise myself how I've managed to create something of a life on this foggy shore out of the broken pieces of myself, scavenged from the sea like flotsam. Or is it jetsam? It irks me not to know the difference. I will have to consult my oracle, my moldy edition of Webster's I've acquired since my arrival here, the very edition we had in my childhood home that lived on a stout shelf along with the Nouveau Larousse Illustré, the Deutsches Wörterbuch, and Dahl's Explanatory Dictionary of the Living Great Russian Language. When I was very small, I had to sit on my knees to read these books. Why do you not write in English, Marina? Because when you are flotsam or jetsam, you cling to what is yours. After the landlord's lanky son leaves, a roll in the hay, that delightful image, I lay my Webster's on the scrubbed table in the lantern light to learn that flotsam is the debris left from shipwreck, while jetsam is merchandise thrown overboard from a ship in crisis to lighten the load. Ship in crisis. That it was. The difference seems to be tied to the fate of the ship. Did it survive after shedding those such as myself, tossing us overboard, jetsam, to lighten the load, or did it founder to be torn apart, mastless and rudderless, the planks and boards washed ashore, flotsam? Perhaps one bearing the ship's name, and the name was Revolution. I can hear her a mile off, Elizabeth in her clattering jalopy. I've made cornbread in my iron pot, a Dutch oven, always the Dutch showing up in surprising places. I will have to look that up. My friend has brought a crate of artichokes down from Salinas and Polish vodka, Smirnoff. Where did she find that? The Americans prefer their native bourbons and rye, such a blessing after all those years of bathtub hooch. Her company is sweet, this lovely girl with the lines to grace the hood of a luxury car. Yet she treats me as if I were the exotic one, her movements careful and calm. What have I done to deserve to be treated so tenderly? Am I so dikaya, wild, that I might startle and take flight like a red deer? After dinner, she showers me with gifts, HD's Red Roses for Bronze and the new Wallace Stevens, books she, a student of literature at the University at Berkeley, can ill afford. And now she's hiding something else behind her back, the hazel gold eyes bright, anticipatory. I pour more vodka into our jelly jar glasses and pretend not to notice. Finally, she holds it out, a gift wrapped in a sheet of the San Francisco paper. I flex it thin, paper bound, and try to guess. A layer cake? A phonograph? and then tear open the wrapper. Russian. Kembuit, a book for children. Who Will I Become? By Vladimir Mayakovsky. My heart catches in my throat like fingers in a slammed door. Mayakovsky, dead 2 years now, dead by his own hand, or maybe not, you never know, but dead just the same. Do you know it? She asks, eager to have surprised me. I shake my head, remembering the last time I saw him, in Petrograd, at the House of Arts, a robust and charismatic man, full of swagger. Who will I become? Inside the same stepped verse he came to favor. And this is the ship that sailed on without me, 1928, Government Press. And here are the child's choices: doctor, worker, auto mechanic, pilot, streetcar conductor, engineer. But no Czechist, no apparatchik, and nowhere a poet, nowhere a cloud in trousers. I get very drunk that night in the little cabin and recite aloud everything I know, penned by Vladimir Vladimirovich. I sing it as he did, his thrilling bass voice booming like the waves, so Elizabeth can hear the music. When I run out of his poems, I move on to Chlebnikov, Chernikov, Kuryakin. My pretty friend cannot believe how many lines I know by heart. But this is nothing. There's no end to the flow once the gate is opened. Here they teach children to think, but they don't train the memory. I suppose they cannot imagine what a person might be called upon to endure when a line of poetry can mean the difference between strength and despair. I drip candle wax into my glass, watch the drops swirl and adhere. What are you doing? She asks. It's something we used to do to tell our fortunes. I recite for her. On St. Basil's Eve, cast the wax in water. At midnight, cast the wax. Sing the song the girls have sung since ancient times. Prepare, my dear, if you dare, my dear, to see your future. Part 1, The Pouring of the Wax. St. Basil's Eve. Midnight, New Year's Eve. It's 1916. Three young witches gathered in the city that was once St. Petersburg. Though that silver sound, Petersburg had been erased, and how oddly the new one struck our ears, Petrograd, a sound like bronze, like horseshoes on stone, hammer on anvil, thunder in the name, Petrograd. No longer Petersburg of the bells and water, the city of mirrors, of transparent twilights, Tchaikovsky ballets, and Pushkin's genius. Its name had been changed by war. Petersburg was thought too German, though the name is Dutch. Petrograd. The sound is bronze, and this is a story of bronze. That night, the cusp of the new year, 1916, we three prepared to conjure the future in a nursery of a grand flat on Verstadskaya Street. From down the hall, sounds of a large New Year's Eve soiree filtered in under the door. Scraps of music, women's high laughter, the scent of roasted goose and Christmas pine. Behind us, my younger brother Seryozha sketched in the window seat as we girls prepared the basin and the candle. I was a month shy of 16, the same age as the century, my brother 1 year younger. Waiting for midnight, our three heads converged over the basin of water, Varvara's cropped locks, the dusty blue-black of a crow, Mina's ash-blonde as Finnish birch, and I with hair the red of young foxes crossing a field of snow, waiting to see our fortunes, Kembuit indeed. A son, a seal, a wedding ring, a house, a plow, a prison cell. It seems like a scene in a glass globe to me now. I want to turn it over and set the snow to swirling. I want to shout to my young self, stop. Don't be in such a hurry to peel back the petals of the future. It will be here soon enough, and it won't be quite the bloom you expect. Just stay there in that precious moment at the hinge of time. But I was in love with the future, in love with the idea of fate. There's nothing more romantic to the young until its dogs sink their teeth into your calf and pull you to the ground. On St. Basil's Eve, we cast the wax in water, and the country, too, had poured its wax in the year of the 9 and the 6. I see her there, staring impatiently into the candle flame, a girl both brash and shy, awkward and feigning sophistication, in hopes of being thought mysterious, so that people would long to discover her secrets. I want her to stay in that moment before the world changed, before the wax was poured, and the future assembled like brilliant horses loading into a starting gate.
Reading for the next 50 minutes or so. I remember reading this, the prologue to this book when it was still in manuscript in Scotland on a dark and stormy night, and being transported to both Carmel and back to Russia. Let's start there. How did this book evolve? You mentioned that it began as a novel set in Los Angeles. How did Marina first come to you?
It was part of that failed novel that, if anybody's read Wonder Boys, the Michael Chabon, there's two different kinds of writer's block. There's the kind where you can't do anything. You just go in and stare at the page and then take a nap. And then there's the kind where you write and write and write and nothing comes together. But I like this one character. She was an emigre from the Russian, from Russia, post-revolution, and she was such a complex person. And I wrote a short story about her. And I thought, oh, this would be interesting to write a novel about her, but I didn't know her well enough. I didn't know her dreams. I didn't know her memories. So I had to go back and see who she was.
So. This reminds me of Tolstoy's War and Peace, which began as a novel about the Decembrist uprising of 1825,
that.
And he realized he didn't know these characters well enough. He had to go back to the Napoleonic Wars.
Oh, man, yeah. I did not know that.
So, well, you're following in good footsteps.
Oh, man.
So she began as an emigre, and you took her back to the revolution. Why the revolution? What drew you to that moment?
I'm attracted to times of sudden change, where you know, where the top becomes the bottom becomes the top. I think that human beings, when we're faced with sudden change, it's where we really show who we are.
Yes.
And I'm very interested in, my background was in Russian history. I was a history major in college. And nobody wrote a fiction about the Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
They write histories about it. But you never, maybe now, but 10 years ago when I started this thing, you never saw fiction about the revolution because there's no clear good guys and bad guys. I mean, you might have opinions about the revolution, but it's easier to write about the siege of Leningrad. It's easier to write about Stalingrad, although, you know, they're huge and horrific events. The revolution is very subtle, but it was a complete change of an entire society, and for an individual to be coming of age in that, it's the perfect time to be coming of age because everything is up for grabs.
Yes.
And the younger people actually adjusted better in certain ways than the older people did.
Absolutely. Well, that was the case. The fact that the revolution exceeded the grasp of fiction writers was the case at the time as well. It's very hard to find fiction from those years about the revolution.
Right.
The events were simply too real.
Novels take longer. Novelists take longer. We're very slow animals.
Yes.
Poets can react. Boris has a book that's called 1917, which is it's poetry and prose written by people at the time. But poets react faster because they're unpacking a moment.
Yes.
And what the revolution was a series of of explosion, and it's much easier to get a grip on that. The novelist took a long time. In Pasternak, also for political reasons, Pasternak, it was 1956
yes.
when he finished Dr. Zhivago.
And none of these novels is really about the revolution itself. It's a grander canvas. They follow the characters long after the revolution into the Soviet Union.
Right.
I think what makes this book so special is that we really have these great fictional glimpses of the scene itself, of what was happening. And you made her a poet, which
of
certainly
course.
Helps.
There's no poet like a Russian poet.
Oh, well.
It's the truth. They're a special animal. We have poets who worked at the bank or worked at the insurance company, famous, Western poets. Russian poets aren't going to preside at the tea table. You know, that's
yes.
just not going to happen. There's entire dedication there.
And, yeah.
and my character is a very, kind of an incendiary person. So it was, I wanted to see the world through her eyes.
And did your love for Russian culture blossom through poetry? You studied Russian history, but was it the poetry that gave you a certain understanding of the culture?
I started with fiction, as you know. What is Elif Batuman has that book, The Possessed People Obsessed with Russian Literature, and that's me. Okay, so that was me starting in junior high, and I took Russian as my language in high school. I took Russian as my language in college. But it was the fiction. And then when my language skills got good enough, I took a junior year abroad, second junior year abroad. I was slow. And I had my first actual Russian teacher, because this is the Soviet times, they didn't travel. And my first actual Russian teacher was this elegant woman named Valentina. And all the other professors were wearing like baggy cords and these bulky scarves that looks like the moth ate them. And she would be in like knee-high suede boots and pearls. And she would read the poets out loud, and she would sing them. Because if you ever listen to Russian poets, they don't just recite blah, 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 blah. You know, they sing that stuff. And I totally fell in love with it.
That reminds me of a story, if you don't mind my telling very quickly.
Please.
I once gave a talk on a Russian poet, an obscure Russian poet, at an academic conference, and two people showed up to listen to this talk. And there were three people on the panel. Typical. So I gave the talk, and I had a woman, one of the guests, in tears by the end of it. Not because of anything I said, but because I read some of this poet's poems. And afterward, I couldn't help but ask, why are you in tears? She said, well, I remember in the 1980s, when these books first appeared in Russia, he was a poet writing in exile, when they first appeared in Russia, I sold a leather skirt to buy a two-volume edition of his books, and I still have that edition.
Yeah, the Russians, yeah. When I was there as a student in 77, bus drivers could, just reel off Pushkin and Lermontov and the greats, yeah. And the poets could fill a stadium.
Yeah.
And I remember going back 30 years later, and one of the things I like to do is go to a street corner and just look at it, the block lived there,
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was on the corner of Litieny and Pestel, looked up at the windows where Joseph Brodsky lived,
mm-hmm.
In the room and a half, his room and a half, and I mm-hmm. knew which windows. I counted over, and I was like in tears, of course. And I looked over, and there were like seven people on that corner doing just mm-hmm. the same thing. The first time in my life that I had ever been joined on that corner, and that's the Russians. They love their poets.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
They also put them in jail, and they put them in insane asylums.
They love them too much.
That's right.
That's indeed. You know, Stalin was a poet. He had taste.
Uh-oh.
He could judge. So you made her a poet, and I believe you even began writing this in verse.
Yeah, the
right?
First 17 chapters were in verse. I thought, well, she's a poet. I should write it in verse. And I came to my senses, but it took a long time.
Yeah.
So now I just wrote her poetry, and I wrote all the fictional people, I wrote their poetry.
Yes.
And then Boris translated the historical people.
Does she have a real-life inspiration? Is there a marina behind a marina?
There is. There, in that Silver Age, poets born mostly around 1880, 1885, the Silver Age generation. There was a poet named Marina Tsvetaeva. And the most well-known poet of the age was Anna Akhmatova, who was sort of the tragic muse. She was, so beautiful, so serene, so able to put her finger on the precision, the precise detail. And then there's this woman from Moscow named Marina Tsvetaeva, who is just like fire incarnate. She's chaos on four wheels. She is, but passionate, and there's a lot of speed in her work, dashes and exclamations. This woman is burning down the house. And of course, my character, Marina, takes the tone of Tsvetaeva, although Tsvetaeva was also, she was kind of stubbornly wrong-headed.
Yes.
In a way that, self-destructive, in a way that my character didn't quite suffer from that.
No, but she also was capable of a great passionate affiliation, and this is something that I think she shares with your Marina.
Yeah.
And it makes Marina a very interesting observer of the revolution. I would even say participant in the revolution, because she goes back and forth. She finds a love in one camp and then a love in another camp. Right. So can you tell us a little bit about the research that went into depicting the political scene and how you were able then to involve it in the life of one character?
Right. Well, first of all, I do like characters who have, they say, straddling the stools in Russian. You know, people who have one foot in one world, one foot in the other. I always find these people interesting because they give you a double experience. You see things twice. And so Marina, having been born in an intelligentsia family, quite well off, very well educated, but also very idealistic and believe in the revolution. So for research, I'm really careful. I was a history major in college, and there's something called research rapture. I don't know if you've heard of research rapture, but you follow a story. If anybody's surfed the internet, you know what I mean. You wake up at 4 in the morning going, what did I do? Where am I? What am I doing here? And that's what research rapture is. So I'm very careful to research and write in tandem. So I'm researching what's under my hands. Mm-hmm. So it keeps me from following the rabbit too far astray. And I had to be very firm on the history for my own sake. I have to know what is real. I can't fake it. My editor sometimes said, well, just put those things together. I was like, but this is history. You can't do that. But once I had the structure of really knowing politically what happened, writers need detail. Like, we need detail like the fish needs oxygen in the tank. The devil is in those details. And not having, my Russian isn't good enough to do original work in Russian, but women's memoirs were wonderful resources because they didn't know what Lenin said to Trotsky at the plenum of whatever. Right. But how did you wash your clothes? How did a phone work? How did a ration card work? The things that women worried about and that are in those memoirs are those details that historians they're trying to get through that to get to the structural details, whereas for novelists, no, don't throw that out. save it for me.
Do you remember any of those trees, not the forest, that particularly stick with you? Is there one detail that you learned that just made you draw back from the chair?
Oh, well, I remember I went back to Russia in 2009. I had a fellowship, the Likhachev Fellowship, which brings American cultural workers to do their project about Russia. for an American audience. So it had my name on it. I just walked up and said, hey, here I am. And to go to Russia and to see a ration car, to see that phone in Bloch's, the poet Bloch's apartment from 1916, that was just amazing to see that ration card, to see the tin little stove that they vented out the window, because the fancier apartments had big stoves, big tile stoves. I'm sure you've seen them in pictures. And they didn't have the fuel for that. So everybody's breathing the smoke, and they don't really know how to handle the stove and keep it from leaking. And, you know, just going there and seeing the thing itself.
Well, you certainly make us see them in the book.
Thank you.
Is there an opinion that you had about the revolution that changed in the process of the writing of this book? Did you come in with some sense of what the revolution was, what it meant, and did that change as you worked on the novel?
I had I didn't really know how hard life was and how much of people's time was just trying to get fuel for the little stove, standing in line in 20, 30 below, standing in line for like 8 hours for bread, for your rations, and then working, you know, and then you have your factory job. To really understand how far my character would have to rise from her very pampered childhood to be an independent person, you know, functioning in the new world. And she does, but it really, you know, she really shows what she's made out of.
She's also that soldier crawling through the mud, like her
That's
maker.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Perseverance. The novel is obviously not a short one. Did you feel that, did you feel it growing under you as you continue to work?
Well, when I changed the verse novel, because in verse, you know, you just make a line. You know, you make a brush stroke, and that will hold. Yes. So it wasn't that big. It wasn't going to be that big a book. Yeah. But then when I had to diversify the verse chapters, it was like, oh, my God. Sometimes I felt like I was building a Gothic cathedral all by myself. It's like, isn't there supposed to be somebody else? You know, isn't this, like, supposed to be a village doing this? Yeah. So sometimes I really despaired. But I just... I have a quote from Dorothy Allison in my office that says, fiction never exceeds a writer's courage. So it's just like, don't fall off the horse. Grab that mane and just don't fall off and stay on.
So in many ways, this was a new experience because of the scope of the novel, its historical context. But is it linked to your other novels? Do you see similarities between Marina and the heroines of your
Oh, I do. I think that she's more of a heroine type of person than my other characters. My other characters are people who are subsumed with self-doubt. And Marina, it's one of her strongest traits is that she has a great deal of self-confidence, which I don't. And so it was really interesting to work with somebody who really took the bit in her teeth. You know, if given an opportunity to have an adventure, she was going to take the adventure. And I was not like that as a kid. You know, I'm like, I double knot my shoes, let's just say, you know. So it was really interesting to write her. So she's similar in, I'm very interested in how women build themselves, how women's character, the girl of 15 makes the decisions that the woman for the rest of her life will end up having to deal with. And I think that in all three books, the kind of the psychology of women is something that really interests me.
And the psychology of romantic relationships. She has a number of very strong relationships, very impactful relationships in this book. Can you tell us a little bit about some of these men?
She has the... You know, she has the boyfriend, the idealist, the revolutionary poet, you know, who's just heroic in every way. But then there's also the older brother's friend from childhood who's an officer and becomes a speculator because trade was illegal under the Bolsheviks. So he becomes sort of a criminal. He is sort of a criminal in his mindset, but he's the charming guy that, you know, if you're going to be stuck on a desert island, this is the guy you want to be with you. And both of these men represent different sides of her, her aspirations, and then also, you know, kind of on the elemental level, who is the one who sets her world on fire. And then there are other people who, as a passionate person, sex is not just an act. You know, sex is a conversation. Sex can be a gift. It can be a barter. It can be a it can be extorted. It can be a, you know, all kinds of, it takes all kinds of forms depending on the context. Mm-hmm. So she has a lot of different approaches to sex and different different languages, really.
Yeah, different economies.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me again as I was listening to the prologue is how good you are about guiding people into the realia, not just of the scenes of the revolution, but into the Russian language. You introduce Russian words, but you always give us enough to understand them. It's very admirable.
And no footnotes. You know, if you don't, you have to get it right in the sentence, or I can't use it. You know, there's no point in showing
Well, your gloss of Dusha is a very powerful one, and I think a very accurate one. And I remember once reading a translation of a book in which Dusha occurs, and it was translated, I thought, very beautifully. It's just one word, four letters in Russian, but it was translated as the very essence of his being. No, the very essence of his whole being.
Right.
That's quite a few words for just four letters in Russian, but we need that sometimes. So I think that you became a very good translator in the process of writing this book, really explaining, giving context.
Because, you know, especially for a poet, the language, the soul of the culture is in the language. And, you know, I want to make sure the reader experiences, you know, you're not reading it to read about Kansas. You're reading it to understand Russia a little bit in Russians. I try to break that open a little bit.
That's very good. I think the last question I'll ask before turning it over to the audience is about your process. This is, again, we say it's a major undertaking. Did you have any help along the way? Do you work with your editor? Do you work with...
Oh, I have such wonderful help. I'm a person full of self-doubt. So if anybody's a writer and has self-doubt, you know, line up, because who doesn't? So I work with a writer's group. There are three writers I work with, two in L.A., David Francis, who I saw earlier, and Rita Williams, who I haven't seen yet, but... I bet you're here somewhere, Rita. And Julianne Cohen, who I saw last night in Seattle. And she Skypes in. We hold her on the phone. And they see everything. And then it was a huge process, and people's eyes glaze. So it's very important to have readers that are still fresh, you know, aren't sick of it, and mm-hmm. as sick of it as you are, you know, and can be fresh. So I have a friend, Jane Chafin. I don't know if she's here tonight, but she was one of my very first readers of White Oleander and of Paint It Black. And then my husband read every scrap of this book a couple of times as I was reading it. He's a writer and has a wonderful sensibility. My daughter, late in the process, I kind of made her read it. She's a cut to the chase girl, you know, too much description. So it's good to know how different readers perceive a book, because some people like certain things. And then my editor is Russian. And she was interesting, because I want her to cut something. And she just kept saying, just write it. Don't worry about how long it is. We'll deal with it. Mm. So that made me feel very nervous, because acceptance is like, are you sure? Are you just, you know? But she was sure, and they published it at length, which
excellent
was amazing.
Yeah. And is there any advice that you would give authors working on something like this, beginning a novel?
Wow. don't follow the rabbit. You know, stay with the story that's coming up from your unconscious. You know, that it's not out here. It's in here. You're using the research to fortify and give shape to what it is you're trying to create.
Excellent. Well, I think on that note, what's taking shape inside of all of you?
Questions. We got time. And ask me anything. I've taught writing. I've suffered. I've been a reader. You know.
Well, speaking of process, I was wondering if there's anything that you do before you actually start sitting down and writing the words. Is there any, you know, meditation or Hemingway used to write standing up with his typewriter mounted on the bookcase. Is there anything you do to get the creative juices flowing?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I never get inspired until I'm actually writing. You know, if I get ideas in the shower or when I'm taking a walk, they are useless. Mm. They're useless. The only decent ideas I ever get is when I'm actually writing and I've been writing for a while and then something comes out of that. So I feel like people should be cautious about developing rituals, because rituals themselves can become an art form. And then you're developing all these beautiful rituals and you never actually get to the writing. Mm. So I'd say, you know, okay, burn incense if you want to, you know, chant something briefly, but try not to get try not to get obsessed with the preparation. You know, get in there, start working, and then if you need to pray a little bit, groovy, you know. But try not to fetishize the preparation.
Okay. So you mentioned that you really loved your character when you started her, even though it wasn't, the short story wasn't, and you just felt like you didn't know her well enough. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that you did when you felt comfortable writing her story that so you could get to know her?
Well, first I had to decide, like, what kind of a family did she come from? I know that she was an educated woman and a poet. I had to pick a city because I'm very much a writer of place. Place is everything to me. I have to know where everything needs to happen. So I had to pick a place. I picked Petersburg because it's smaller. I'd live there. It was more containable. Like, Moscow is more like L.A. and Petersburg is more like San Francisco. It's easier to hold it all in your head. It's also the more Western city. Tremendous literary tradition. So I placed her there, and then I had to figure out who her family was, where she lived. I knew by reading biographies of poets, what they read. Like, I knew what Tsvetaeva read when she was a little girl. She was a prolific reader. So I kind of knew her literary background. And then you just start building her. Getting to know her. Yeah, it took a while. And who are her friends? You know, how does she fall politically? You know, I had to sort all that out. And then I knew. Then I started to know her.
Mm-hmm. So each woman that you wrote about, so Astrid, Josie, and now Marina, you were talking about the psychological differences in each woman and how they represent. I kind of use your book, White Oleander, to teach a group that I work with.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're a huge inspiration for me. But each one of these women, like you said, you have a different psychological view of them. Like, what's Let's see, what's your different type of your view?
Well, the view of, I mean, of the three, where do they come from? Astrid comes out of loneliness, tremendous, tremendous loneliness. So she's looking to attach. Josie is someone who is trying to find a larger world. You know, she comes from a very small world, and she was actually kind of happy with where she got, you know, when she was a little punk princess. That was like, wow, look at me, this is groovy. And then somebody threw open the doors, and she very much wanted a larger world for herself. That was modeled after my mother. She grew up very poor here in L.A., and she was really interested in knowing a bigger world and just making life bigger. And then other issues came in that book. And in this book, it's what would happen if I had absolute self-confidence? What would that be like? You know, oh, do you make mistakes? You know, because you believe in what you're doing. And it's like, what happens to women? You know, many of us are plagued with self-doubt. So what happens to people who aren't, you know? And then how they live with the fallout is really very interesting to me. Thank you. There was one up here.
Janet, it occurred to me while you were chatting, I wondered whether and how this novel fits into the notion of feminism. Is Marina a feminist in her way? And how does that revolution translate to us as readers in this day and age, in this time? I know that's a tough question.
That's an interesting question. I think that revolutionary generation were incredibly feminist. The February Revolution, there were two. The first one came out of strike after strike, hunger, World War I, the terrible Romanov regime. But it began on International Women's Day. It was a march, 1917, International Women's Day. The women just had enough, and they began to march, and it was organized by the socialist women. And it was for it was for equal rights for women and the 8-hour day, and bread is what everybody really needed. The revolution, there was abortion rights, there was equal employment, child care, all these issues were being addressed. They were the most modern country in the world. And Marina is... she's not plagued by her inner contradictions. She is a feminist, and you know her great models, Akhmatova and Tsvetaeva, you know, the great women, the greatest poets of the age were women. But she's also a complete romantic and a sucker for love, and she's not above bartering her favors when necessary. So it's a complex situation.
Well, if there are no more questions, thank you very much, Janet.
Thank you. Thank you, Boris. Thank you guys for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.